Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Before you emailed me, tweeted me an article this week, I had the perfect wine. I had it. It was by you. We've done 19 crimes before, and it was called The Warden.
Ah.
Would have fit Clemency, one of the films we're going to talk about tonight. But then you sent me an article about one Georges Debouffe. Georges Debouffe introduced millions of people to the concept of Beaujolais, and he passed away this week at 86. Therefore, friend of the show, Beaujolais makes a... This one's off. Yeah. And I wonder if it's a 2018, because Beaujolais is not a wine you stick in the cellar to age. It is meant to be drank and drank drunk now. And I wonder if it's almost too old, which is why I'm getting this taste.
Yeah, it could be. I'm kind of curious what the warden might have tasted like. But hey, you know, I do feel, though, that we do need to acknowledge and honor the legacy of Georges, since certainly every year have acknowledged him through his Nouveau.
And this is not Beaujolais Nouveau. It's Beaujolais Villages.
Oh. Okay.
I'm just saying. It's not, we just did the Nouveau episode a couple weeks ago.
Better. I know. Yeah. So, but I think the Nouveau.
Because it's fresh. It's like right off the vine.
Yeah, the Nouveau was better.
All right, we are going to talk about three films tonight and then hop over into the Golden Globe, wrap up our impressions, our aftertaste. And that's actually in preparation for this Monday, the 13th, when Oscar nominations will be announced. So maybe next week we'll do our gut reactions to snubs and how could yous and oh.
I look forward to it. It's a fun 8:30 a.m. Eastern time wake up call.
All right, our first film this week is a January film, and a lot of people know what I mean when I say January film, but it's not the most January of January films I've ever seen.
We've seen worse.
Hannah, where does the science fiction horror film Underwater take place?
Let me see. I think it took place underwater.
No kidding.
However, it was also murky
from
the plot onward that I can't guarantee exactly where it took place.
Are you saying more than the camera work was murky?
And the geography, I had no idea where we were supposed to be at any given time and where they were headed, and I don't know. But yes, Underwater is the appropriate title for this film.
Specifically, where underwater are we?
Good question. I think they did say that they put a little locator on
it. We're in a famous place. We are in a famous place.
Where was it? I must have just missed
it. It's the Mariana Trench. The trench of all trenches. The Mariana Trench, which goes 7 miles underground. Down. All the way down. That's where they are. Mankind, corporations, multinationals are now drilling down there. And we all know from various movies, there are certain places man is not meant to go. We just saw the Meg, a year and a half ago. We are not meant to go certain places or we'll unleash megalodons. In this case, man is drilling on the bottom of the most deepest ocean floor. Something is released. I'm not exactly sure what it is. And we don't really have time to speculate, let alone get to know any characters, because the action, the implosion, the collapse of the station that our heroine, Kristen Stewart, Nora is on, within the first minute of the film, explodes, and she has to start running.
Yeah, and then that's pretty much it. That's the whole movie. and then it just becomes, okay, you're running, and you run into some other survivors, and then you all have to figure out how in the world you're possibly going to survive and get to certain escape pods when your entire lab is, the infrastructure's collapsing around you. And the first 15, 20, 30 minutes even, totally on board. The score is great, very gripping. It feels like one of these films that's at least going to be this 95-minute-long, intense, edge-of-your-seat kind of film. But somewhere around, I don't know, by the middle of this film, I was done. I was just bored. It wasn't doing anything for me. And as you mentioned, there's zero character development. And when you have no character development, you have no stakes. You don't care if these people, which ones possibly get eaten alive or what else might happen to them. I just didn't care.
Bored, I think, is the correct word. We're working with a small cast here, only six people, very reminiscent of Alien. The whole thing is very reminiscent of Alien.
Of a ripoff of Alien.
But when one dies, as they inevitably do in a certain order, I did not care, because I never got to know them. I think I learned most of their names. I got a little backstory about a little bit how they fit together. One of them was the captain, one of them was a useless research scientist. Kristen Stewart, Nora, was very useful. She was a mechanical engineer. But when one goes, you're like, I barely got to know you, so I'm not that sad that you're now gone. Even though I was bored, I did feel something. I wonder if you felt too. Did you ever at times feel claustrophobic?
I did. And this is not a film that anyone with any sense of claustrophobia should even consider seeing. Because on this big screen, definitely there are times where they are basically trying to traverse some very close spaces, and yes, I did feel a tad claustrophobic, but that to me, that wasn't enough. It's like, okay, if you're gonna feel claustrophobic, you want there to be a point at which it felt like it was worth it, and I did not feel that. And I don't know, it's interesting. This one has like a 51% right now on Rotten Tomatoes, and that's pretty much exactly what I'm finding, is that half the people I know who saw it liked it. You know, nobody was like overly enthusiastic in their endorsement, but about half liked it and half did not. And I think you and I kind of fall in that do not category. But, you know, I guess if you're just really inclined to watch any sci-fi horror film and it's January and there's nothing else that you really want to watch, although there's so much better stuff out there, then, you know, maybe the horror contingent will seek it out. But boy, I just, I was not feeling it, did not like it. Kristen Stewart's running around in her underwear half the time. And I was like, you know, the only thing I really learned from this is that you don't want to be caught in an earthquake in your skimpiest underwear. Although it does help you fit into a pressurized suit a lot easier when you have to don one of those.
Well, even though we just saw a few months ago Kristen Stewart in Charlie's Angels, this was not filmed after Charlie's Angels. In fact, this was filmed a couple years ago. It sat on the shelf for a while. This is even back before T.J. Miller got in trouble, because he's a cast member here. A friend of the program, Eddie Passa, liked this film. He also said he liked the director William Eubank. He liked him from a film called The Signal, which I have not seen.
Me either.
But I read his take, and I learned about the xiphoid process. We had a little discussion on Facebook today about the xiphoid process. I'm not going to go into it, but it turns out when I say process, I don't mean like process.
It's a bone. It's a breastbone. Yes. And I was so excited because I actually was familiar with the xiphoid process and where it's located and its usefulness. But yeah, I think Eddie was trying to demonstrate some anatomy, because for some reason, Kristen Stewart's character for the first part of the film is just constantly reaching down her shirt.
What does it say about me that I never noticed it? I never saw it. I didn't notice it.
I totally noticed it, and it was starting to get really aggravating. And they give it a reason at the end, but I was not sold. I was like, what? Why does she keep touching her breastbone like that? And sure enough, there's a very strange, not satisfying reason for it. But yeah, xiphoid process. If you know where it is, you probably have learned CPR.
Stop looking at my xiphoid process. Get out of there. All right, for some reason, it's not, you know, it's sometimes in the news, sometimes it's not. And it has not been in the news. For whatever reason, in 2019, the death penalty has not been in the news. It's not as a hot button of an issue as it has been in the past. You know, state by state, more and more states are just getting rid of it. But for some reason, back-to-back in some markets, in our market, same week, we get two films about, revolving around, the death penalty, the abuse of it, the injustice of it, but they go about it differently. The first film we're going to talk about is the bigger film. It's got bigger word of mouth. It actually is getting nominated for an award here or there. It's called Just Mercy. It won the local Virginia Film Festival. I know a friend of the program, Christian Hammaker, saw it there, and I think that was his favorite film there. The only thing, though, a major nomination it has so far is a SAG nom, a SAG nomination for supporting actor for Jamie Foxx.
And I actually put him down for supporting actor when we did the WAFCA Awards. I did try and nominate him for that because I did feel that Jamie Foxx delivers a really good performance alongside the headliner of this film, which is Michael B. Jordan.
So how, Hannah, does Just Mercy confront the death penalty? What are they doing?
Well, Just Mercy is based on a true story. And so that's the first critical factor. But it's also based on a memoir written by this Harvard-educated lawyer, Brian Stevenson, who went on to create the, I think it was called the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama, sort of a nonprofit that would help represent the disenfranchised. And he takes on this case in, in the 90s, of this guy who had been convicted of a crime, of a murder that he did not commit, and all of his appeals were being denied. But it was so obvious to Stevenson and to others that this guy was sent to death row. He was supposed to be executed, and the evidence against him was virtually non-existent. It was crazy that his appeals were denied. The justice system had just completely failed this guy. And so this is the much more uplift. In the end, it's a much more uplifting film because Stevenson gets the guy exonerated. And I do recall there was a 60-minute segment about this case, and that really put it in the public spotlight.
Is that a spoiler?
No, because I remember it's in the film, and it's not a spoiler at all. It's not that none of this is a spoiler. If you read Just Mercy, if you read Brian Stevenson's book.
I did not, but the entire University of Maryland has. Apparently it was a campus book.
It's made the rounds. I got a copy. There was a documentary about Brian Stevenson, and he himself was at the opening night of the AFI Documentary Film Festival last year, and everyone in the audience got a copy of his book. And so I was actually already quite familiar with his work and considered him sort of this modern-day superhero. And to be able to get yourself played by Michael B. Jordan, that's not too bad.
Directed by Destin Daniel Cretton. I loved his first film, Short Term 12. That introduced us, by the way, to a slew of talent. Not only Brie Larson,
who's in this film,
Best
as well.
Actress winner, who he has brought back for this film, and it's somewhat thankless supporting role, but she's nice to see. Yeah. But the film also introduced us to a person named Rami Malek, a Best Actor winner, and Lakeith Stanfield.
Wow.
Yeah. He also did The Glass Castle, which I neither read nor saw.
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't think I saw that one either. But yeah, I mean, Brie Larson plays like this legal assistant. She's a co-founder. Her character actually co-founded the Justice Initiative along with Stevenson. But she's more of this sort of Aaron Brockovich light kind of character. She is not given much to do. And I was actually kind of surprised when you realize it's like, wow, that's Brie Larson in what is really this very small role. But then you start understanding sometimes how these directors really have their the actors who really like to work with them. And so I think this was a case where he really was able to bring in a bunch of his folks from films like Short Term 12.
Well, in my opinion, I think the best performance was actually not Jamie Foxx. It was from Tim Blake Nelson, who plays the main witness against Walter McMillan. He was so convincing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, bit of trivia here. This Just Mercy is the first major studio film to adopt an inclusion rider, a contractual provision that mandates women, people of color, members of the LGBTQ community be considered for on-screen and behind-the-scenes jobs. If you remember when Frances McDormand kept winning for Three Billboards in Ebbing, Missouri, I remember one of her speeches. It might have been the Independent Spirit Awards. Mm-hmm. She got up on stage and she stared at the crowd and she says, "Inclusion rider." No one, you know, us lay people didn't really know what she was talking about. But then it was, you know, various articles explained it. And now Just Mercy comes along and has adopted the first film, Inclusion Rider, so good on them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just one more reason to go see this. This is very much a accessible, conventional legal drama with, an inspiring, a message, a real message and a call to action, I would say, throughout and at the end to really make you think about the death penalty and about how it's applied And so I do think that there's just a lot to really appreciate about this film.
You sound like you liked it a little bit better than I did. I really liked the first half. I thought it was very gripping. It made me angry. I was frustrated. How dare the Alabama racist justice system? Ugh. And then the second half got into the courtroom scenes. It got very speechifying. I'm like, okay, a little bit melodramatic here.
But but that's where it turns into your conventional few good men kind of a vibe for me.
Yana, please.
Because I already knew.
Please the court.
Oh, no. Because I already had a general sense of the story going in. It is truly one of those based on a true story where then you go, okay, so it's a film based on a true story, but what's true and what's dramatized for the filmmaking? You know, with Clint Eastwood took a lot of flack about some of the portrayals in the Richard Jewell film. And, you know, every single film that's based on a true story, you will read that a lot of the facts get, time gets condensed and changed and character situations get consolidated. Things that happened at one time or didn't really. And that's the case here. McMillan was not a saint, the guy who was convicted. But he wasn't a killer. And so the point is really that you are, you know, even though they gloss over a lot of his shortcomings, he was a womanizer. He was having an affair with a white woman. He was a black guy. That was part of what actually had gotten him arrested, is that the town in Alabama really was a racist motivation for arresting him. But he was not completely, you know, this great guy, but the fact that he was then railroaded and convicted, you just realize that the injustice of it all and the irony that it all took place in the same Alabama town where Harper Lee was from, and she is best known for having written To Kill a Mockingbird. So there's some interesting intersections going on, but it's still dramatized for becoming a more of a crowd pleaser, unlike Clemency, which is not designed to be a crowd pleaser so much as a really interesting psychological character study, I would say, involving the death penalty.
Yeah, whereas Just Mercy is more of a study of the failure of an entire system, Clemency is the study, it's a character study of one person involved in executions. And what I immediately thought of when it's like, okay, I've seen a couple death row pictures now in my lifetime, and this is the first one that ever asked, won't somebody think about the warden? So Clemency is focused on Bernadine Williams, Warden Bernadine Williams, played by Alfre Woodard, and she is on her 12th execution as warden of this particularly harsh prison, I guess, which has a lot of executions. And it appears to start to take a toll on her. The execution number 11 does not go smoothly. Something happens, things fall apart, feelings are getting frayed, and it's affecting her performance at work and certainly affecting her relationship with her husband at home. Nominated for 3 Independent Spirit Awards, including Woodard's performance, screenplay, and Best Feature. This also won a very prestigious prize at Sundance, the Dramatic Grand Jury Prize. And it beat films such as The Farewell, The Last Black Man of San Francisco, and Honey Boy. This beat all of those to get that prize. Won't somebody think of the warden? It is and is not based on a true story. The director, Chinoye Chukwu, was paying attention in 2011 in Georgia to a man named Troy Davis, where before he was executed, all of these letters poured in, including from former wardens saying, do not execute this man. There is enough reasonable doubt in this case where we may be putting to death an innocent man. And that got her thinking and got her to make the movie Clemency. What must it be like for the people who had to execute Troy Davis?
Yeah, and I think that's what makes this particular film unique. You know, whereas Just Mercy feels like stuff you've seen before, Clemency, you feel like it's showing you something you haven't seen before. The downside of that is that I'm not so sure all that many people will want to see it. It's very bleak. It's kind of a tough watch. The performances are excellent. I mean, Alfred Woodward, watching her act is just phenomenal. Aldous Hodge as one of the 12th person slated, I believe, to be executed. You know, his character is a very interesting one to watch as well. But it's not your, in the end, uplifting feel-good film. It's a bit of a downer. And I think it's kind of unfortunate that they're both out at the same time.
Well, it is an R market. Just Mercy has been open in New York and L.A. for a week or two, and now this weekend it expands nationwide, like 2,700 theaters. Clemency is still very, very small. We're talking 10, 11 screens at the most. It will expand later, maybe, if it makes some more money.
Yeah,
Clemency is deliberately slow. It is actually very, very slow. Not a lot happens in the film. And, oh, man, it suffers for it. It's not that I was ever truly bored. It's a different kind of boredom than Underwater, which is like action boredom. This is just Alfred Woodard staring into a liquor concoction boredom.
Yeah, no, I agree. I did not, you know, I didn't love this film. I love the performances, but I did not particularly like the movie. And, you know, it's good. And it just complements Just Mercy to some degree in that, again, it just absolutely, in a much more shocking way, makes you think about how the death penalty
just
is
Mercy
enforced.
Is the death row family film, and Clemency is the art house
it is.
Death row film.
It is.
Take your family to the feel-good death row picture.
Yeah, don't go taking them to Clemency, because that first, I remember the first 15 minutes is pretty brutal to watch.
All right, well, since we are now into 2020, and actually the regional film critics have all submitted, where all the cities are done, but the big ones are now upon us. And the first really big one this year was the Golden Globe Awards, hosted by Ricky Gervais. Let's talk about Ricky first. I thought he was funny. I did not mind that it got awkward because he was pointing out the room's hypocrisy. You all knew Epstein and flew on his jets and you're all whatever, you know, pointing out the room's hypocrisy. I'm totally fine with that. I'm, you know, they're rich enough to be made fun of. Fine. But I didn't, it's not that he didn't command the room. I don't know if he totally commanded the television. He actually came off as very, not mean. Mean is not the word. He came off as just irritated. And it didn't, if he's not enjoying himself there, and I think it was an act, I'm going to pretend like I'm not enjoying myself, then I'm not going to really enjoy myself.
Yeah, no, it did. I think that you're right on the money that it translated that way, that I did not enjoy watching the Golden Globes this year. There weren't any great moments, and Ricky Gervais actually kind of disappeared for huge chunks of time, so there was no thread. I didn't feel there was any continuity to the kinds of jokes that he was trying to make. And yeah, I don't care that, you know, I was just as happy to see him slam the crowd for certain things, or just you know, point out that hypocrisy. But yes, I think when you start off saying, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care, I'm going to say what I'm going to say because I'm never going to be back here doing this again, it's like, wait a beat or two. Wait until you're like into your third or fourth joke where people are just like, oh my God, I can't believe you're going there. And then perhaps lay into the fact that you don't ever expect to be invited back. I think by flipping that script, it did not work at all. And there were no real great moments, and I was missing the moments, and there were no great presenters.
Well, there were two.
There were two. Well,
very good, and it's presented
that way. The
moments
had nothing to do with the awards for the current films. But there
well,
were
all right. Well, the highlight moments, the bookend moments, they're meant to, you know, make you, I don't know, nostalgic, was Ellen DeGeneres' television award and Tom Hanks' film award, and they were
both
wonderful speeches.
They were. Mm-hmm.
If I had to pick an actual award where the winner was not only shocked but fresh and just new to the whole thing, was the original score The woman who won for Joker was so flabbergasted. And I know she broke a barrier to be like the first solo female to win Best Score. And it was just, what a delightful thing when that happened. Oh, and when Missing Link won animated.
That was the biggest surprise to me, was Missing Link winning Best Animated, because you could just hear people going, which one was that? And I just have this feeling that somehow that the vote was divided between things like Toy Story 4 and Frozen 2, and that Missing Link just somehow managed to then bubble up to the surface. Because I just, other than the fact that it has Hugh Jackman, and I think the foreign press love Hugh Jackman, as do I.
Maybe also has Selma Hayek voices, in it.
And maybe Selma got some credit for.
Well, you know, I'm glad stop motion got some favoritism finally. What? Not the worst speech. There were plenty of worst speeches. We all knew Joaquin Phoenix was going to get weird, and he did. He did not disappoint. But you know, he got weird and doesn't. He never does himself any favors. It's Quentin Tarantino. Yes, you did write the year's best script. Yes, you did. I agree. But boy, do you know it, brother. And you will tell us that you know it. And I just wonder, remember, the Golden Globes and the Oscars do not overlap in any voters. Zero. Nada. If you win a Golden Globe, entirely different voters are with you on the Oscars. It doesn't really mean a thing. Yes, it gives you, but like 1917, best thing that could have happened to it. It won the Granddaddy Award. It won Best Drama, and it opens wide today.
That was, to me, the most refreshing and
perfect
exciting
timing
and great award was 1917. Beating what I think everyone considered to be other front runners. And all I kept thinking was, yeah, actually, now that I think back on it, I've always felt that Sam Mendes deserved Best Director for 1917, because it's, to me, just a phenomenal directorial achievement with the film. And I love to see that it won Best Drama. However, the biggest thing for me with Golden Globes versus Oscars, it's a joke how they separate these categories, that they can put half of these films into the drama category and the actors as well, and then half go into this totally absurd, never on target comedy and or musical category. And so for once upon a time in Hollywood to be able to say, okay, that's the best comedy. I'm sorry, it was not a comedy.
It reminds me of the year The Martian was
it
the
did.
Best
that's
comedy.
That's what it reminded me of. It's like just when The Martian, you're like, that's not a comedy. But same with the actors, so that you have this split where...
Well, Taron Egerton won.
Yes.
And he's on the bubble of getting nominated for an Oscar.
But I thought that was... He would never have won if they didn't divide that category. Joaquin
Phoenix
was
always
going to
be Joaquin, maybe Adam Driver.
But it's the same thing, I think, with Awkwafina winning. I mean, great. She broke a barrier as the first Asian American to win the Best Actress
But also
category.
On the bubble for an Oscar nom.
But also on the bubble, because Renee Zellweger, I think, was by far. And she won for musical or comedy for Judy. And so the thing is, that was a dramatic role as much as anything.
It was all drama. I know that she sang a lot, and you can call it a musical.
Yeah.
It's a drama film.
So they're both dramas. So you have Awkwafina and Renee Zellweger both winning for for Best Actress, and the categories are not appropriate for the films that they were. And if you had to stack Awkwafina's performance overall up against what Renee Zellweger did in channeling and really embodying so much of Judy Garland, even though I didn't think Judy
was well, they actually did not nominate the year's best actress. Lupita Nyong'o was not there.
Yeah, exactly. We all like Lupita Nyong'o for us as best actress. So it will be interesting to see how the Oscar nominations pan out, because I do think that the Golden Globes, by separating things, being able to separate them into those
they'll never
two wonky
change
categories.
Ratings. You get all those stars
you
in
get
that
all
room.
The stars. I know.
And that's not going to change.
No. And you know, as long as they keep the champagne flowing, the stars will show up.
The Irishman was shut out.
I love that The Irishman was shut out.
Ooh.
And
was Marriage Story shut out?
Marriage Story.
Or did they pick up something?
I don't know if it picked
up
anything.
I don't remember
anything.
Them winning.
Yeah, so you know, it's definitely a little bit more of a pop culture accessible kind of event, and it really feels like it kicked off the award season, And so we'll see what happens with the Oscar nominations. But I think it's going to be so much harder to whittle it all down for the Oscar nominations, because you won't be able to, you know, someone like Taron Egerton, who I think would be awesome to have on stage with Elton John. Can you see, if you needed another like musical moment at the Oscars, a duet with Elton John and Taron Egerton would, I think, be a great thing to see at the Oscars.
Well, in Oscar news, they announced this year's host. And for a second year in a row, it is no host.
Nobody.
Last year, they brought out Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and Maya Rudolph for somewhat of an opening montage monologue. It was a couple minutes long. And then, you know, then it was just hosts. Then it was just presenters for the rest of the evening. And I think it was just like underwater. Half the people were like, this is great. This is flowing. Let's move it along. And the other half is like, where's my host? Where's Billy Crystal? Where's Steve Martin? I need a host. Part of me misses a host. Hosts can bomb. They can't, James Franco. Hosts can soar to, you know, I thought Jimmy Kimmel did a very good job not too long ago. When I first heard no host, I immediately thought, what, you're never going to try out Bill Hader or Keegan-Michael Key? These are two guys, I think, who would nail hosting duties. But they're going to, once again, no host, which, you know, maybe it'll make the thing go faster.
It's hard to say. It's a gamble. It's always a gamble. But it worked last year. But it worked because I think it has to be well-produced, well-paced. They need to minimize the boring pre-packaged productions that they sometimes do. They need to make sure that the musical performances are the original people and are good. And then you need like that. You need that Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper kind of moment. Yeah. You need the one you don't know is coming that is just quietly just surprises. And so I do think that's very important. You need some serendipity, and it's a crapshoot whether or not they'll get it. What a host can sometimes provide, but which, you know, the Golden Globe show doesn't really necessarily matter, is the host is supposed to be this thread of continuity. And so if you can't deliver that thread and be responsive in the moment in a really good way, the way that a Billy Crystal could just react, then yes, you don't want a host. But if you don't have really good presenters and some way of feeling connected as an audience to respond in the moment, to react to what's going on, then not having a host becomes a little more tricky. But I think this year either it will be like last year and people will say, you know, that worked out pretty well, and it will really be the way that they go until they feel really comfortable in a different host selection, or it won't go so well and next year we will see the return of a host.
A master of ceremonies, if you will.
Whatever you want to call it. It won't be Ricky Gervais, but there are, as you mentioned, some really decently good, talented people. Last year would not have worked if you didn't have the talents of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler going out there with some really good material. And so that's critical. And if they get that again, it is. It's critical to enjoying, to hanging around for 3.5 hours for
I don't know about the average viewer. Between now and the Oscars, we still have others to get through. We have to get through the Critics' Choice Awards. We have to get through the Screen Actors Guild Awards, the Independent Spirit Awards. And I'm going to watch it all, I swear, just for you guys. And then we'll get there. All right, but first we're going to wrap up the show. We talked about Underwater, which is right. I think audiences like it more than critics at the moment. I was underwhelmed by Underwater.
No tanks.
Just Mercy, the feel-good Death Row picture of the year.
Bryan Stevenson is a superhero, and he's still alive, and he's still doing his thing as a lawyer. And so, you know, hey, I think if you're going to watch something based on a true story that can provide some inspiration, I think you'd do worse than to take a look at Just Mercy.
Clemency, won't someone think about the warden for once?
You didn't even bring the warden wine, therefore you were not thinking of the warden.
Because you're the one who derailed it. It's the second best Death Row film you'll see this week.
That's right. Yeah, put it in your Death Row queue, and maybe eventually, just for the performances of, especially of Alfred Woodard, it's maybe worth seeing.
The best film of the week is the first half of Just Mercy. And actually, if you're in the DC area, one screen, the West End, is actually showing I Lost My Body, my favorite animated film of the year.
Wow. And I would still say, though, that if you haven't seen a film like 1917 and it's rolling out around you, that still, to me, ranks higher. So I would certainly, nobody has any justification in seeing Underwater before they've seen 1917.
Hear, hear. Mm-hmm. Hear, hear. And here's to you, Mr. DeBoof. Thank you for the Beaujolais.
Yes.
All right. Well, on behalf of the Cinema Clash, thank you very much for listening to this episode. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.